analyze them by doing a unitary transformation. And in fact, we have to do a biunitary transformation for every Yukawa matrix in the standard model, which is equivalent to just rotating our basis. For every triplet in generation space, we have to do another transformation to rotate it into the mass basis in which all of those Yukawa interactions are diagonal. Once we do that, we went back and worried about some of the other terms. In particular, we looked at the weak interactions. The neutral current interactions, the coupling of the Z and the photon, don't transform because they start out proportional to the identity in generation space, and so doing this unitary transformation has no effect. So the mass basis for the neutral current interactions is still diagonal, still universal, proportional to the identity. But we ran into a subtlety with the charge current interactions, and once we do this rotation, because the up and down type fields rotate differently under different unitary transformations, we're left over with an extra unitary matrix that couples up and down type quarks. All right, so the summary was, for the charge current interaction, the interaction of the W was as follows. We were left with G over square root of 2, U bar left I Vij W slash plus D left J. And then we also had a coupling to the neutrino and the charged lepton, which was diagonal, as long as the neutrinos are still massless. Okay. So we're left over with this extra matrix Vij, which is the CKM matrix. And what I had on Friday involved primes. Primes are supposed to denote the mass basis fields, but I'm just going to drop the primes from now on, so we're just working in the mass basis, yes.
So if the neutrino did have a mass, would there be some equivalent for the of the VCKM matrix?
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
so
would there be measurable difference?
Yeah, of course. So if you do want to include a mass for the neutrino, I should write something very similar. And typically, people use the letter U. So you'd write U, I, J, W plus E left J, like this, plus emission conjugate. And this matrix U is also a unitary matrix. And it's named after the people that wrote it down first, who have this in these initials. Okay, so it looks very similar. And just like experimentally, we want to measure all of the different elements in this matrix. It's also a big experimental program for neutrinos to try to measure all of the parameters in this PMNS matrix as well. Okay. Now, we have the neutral current, the charge current Lagrangian. The next thing I want to discuss is what's known as effective theory for the weak interaction. So the idea is that for weak processes, with energy E, which is much, much below the weak scale set by the mass of the W and the Z, we don't need to use all of the degrees of freedom in the standard model. We can integrate out those heavy degrees of freedom to write down a simpler Lagrangian, which is known as an effective Lagrangian. So we don't need, you could say we can integrate out the heavy degrees of freedom. And And I just mean heavy compared to the energy scale, so in particular the W and the Z. To get an effective Lagrangian. So how do you do this process of quote unquote integrating out heavy fields? Well, the idea is that you just do the calculation twice. First, we'll do the calculation in the full standard model, and we'll write down the matrix element for a given process. And then we're going to ask, what sort of operators could we have written down to generate that same interaction? So let's just take a simple example, which is muon decay. So we want to calculate the matrix element for a muon to decay into a muon neutrino. An electron antineutrino. So the diagram will look like this. So here's a muon neutrino, electron neutrino. So the momenta will be, this will be P prime, Q prime, and this will be K. Which will be the W minus. All right, so I'm just going to calculate this matrix element. There's the Lagrangian. All I need is the second term, and I'm going to set U to be the identity. So I have some spinners. Then I'll just leave off the momenta. I G over square root of 2 with the minus sign, gamma mu, P left, and I have V nu E. Then I have the W propagator, which is minus I over K squared over MW squared. Eta mu nu minus K mu K nu over MW squared. And then I have U bar nu mu minus I G over square root of 2 gamma nu P left and then U mu. Okay, so the first thing that I want to do is look at this term here and argue that it does not contribute in this limit where we're at low energy. So first we'll consider the k mu, k nu term. And we want to use the Dirac equation. So for example, where I have k mu, it will contract with a gamma mu to get k slash. And I can use the Dirac equation to substitute that k slash for the masses of these fields. So where I have u bar e k slash p left v nu e, this is just u e. And then k, the momentum of the w, will just be it's over here, Q plus Q prime. The Q prime will go through the P left, turn it into a P right, but then when it hits the neutrino field, you'll get the neutrino mass, which we're setting to zero, so the Q slash prime won't contribute. The Q slash will hit this and give us an electron mass. So this will be ME, U bar E, P left, V nu E. And similarly, for the muon current part, K nu will contract with gamma nu, and it'll get something proportional to the muon mass. Okay, so this term here will give me ME M mu over MW squared, which is a really small number. So this term is suppressed by ME M mu over MW squared, which is around 10 to the minus 8. Okay, so we can throw away this extra term. Yeah.
Can you just explain how you got the masses, like how you contracted the gammas and the masses there?
Sure. So for the first term, k mu goes into gamma mu to give k slash. And k is the momentum of the w here. And so k is equal to p minus p prime. And it's also equal to q plus q prime. Mm-hmm. OK, so I'm considering the electron current part here. So I'm putting in q plus q prime. So if I just add an extra step here, I have nu e q slash p left v nu e plus ue bar p right q slash prime v nu e. OK? And then I want to use the Dirac equation, which in general tells me that if I act with momenta on a spinner, I get the mass. I can just trade p slash for the spinner. And so you can do it on the left, and you can do it on the right. So that's what I've done. OK. So if we're interested in this low-energy regime, and here the energy is set by the muon mass, that's what sets the energetics of the decay, we can throw away this extra term in the propagator. And we're only left with this. So that's the only term I need to consider. So I'll have I times the matrix element for this process. Is I times m squared over 8 mw squared u bar e gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 v nu e. And then I have u bar nu mu gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 u mu. Hopefully it's clear what the notation is. I can try to be a little bit more clear. These are Lorentz mu's. Everything else is a mu for a muon. So let me just write a different index here. OK. How did I get the factor of 8? Well, I have a 2 here. And then each one of the projectors has a half. And so that will give me 8. I have two gauge couplings. That's the g squared. And the other simplification that I made is that in the propagator, I had k squared minus mu squared in the denominator. K squared is set by the muon mass, all right? And so the k squared term is much smaller than mw squared. And so I can throw away the k squared term compared to mw. So I'm using the fact that mw is much, much larger than all momenta scales. Such as k. OK, so this is what I get. So I have this particular matrix element. And now I want to do the second step, which is ask, what term in the Lagrangian could I have written, and this will be the effective Lagrangian, to generate exactly this same matrix element? This is the process of integrating out heavy degrees of freedom. So the operator that I would need to write down to get this matrix element effective Lagrangian, because I'm not working in the full Lagrangian. It's a 4 fermion operator, because I have 4 spinners here. So I'll have E bar gamma alpha 1 minus gamma 5 E. And then I have nu mu bar gamma alpha 1 minus gamma 5 mu. So these are supposed to be fields, not the spinners, which appear in the matrix element. And then I have to introduce an overall coupling in front of this operator. which is conventionally defined as GF over square root 2. And then I should add to this plus emission conjugate. So I can read off what this overall coupling is just by matching this to this. You can compute the matrix element due to this effective Lagrangian, and you just get exactly what you got here. That's how I knew to write down this effective Lagrangian. And now and that tells me, how do I match this overall coefficient onto the full theory? So this coefficient GF over square root 2 is just the same as what's in front of here. G squared over 8mw squared. OK. So this coefficient GF you may have seen before is called Fermi's constant. Historically, people were able to deduce that this was the correct Lagrangian for the weak interaction, describing muon decay and other weak decays. And then they tried to do the inverse process. What high energy theory would give rise to this effective Lagrangian once you integrate it out? And that's how they arrived at the standard model. OK. So now we can ask, what is GF? Well, so I know what MW is. Recall that MW is just G times V over 2. So GF over square root of 2 is 1 over 2 times V squared, because the G's will cancel out. All right, so this is how I know what the VEV is in the standard model. It's just directly related to Fermi's constant. So I would write V is the square root of 2 GF, and then I take the minus square root. So it's fixed. Once I measure Fermi's constant from some weak decays at low energy, then I've totally fixed this numerical value of V. If I plug in what GF is, it's around 246 GeV. OK. So the other thing I just want to mention parenthetically is that we had this convention where we expanded the Higgs field and unitary gauge as only in the lower component. And we wrote it like this, V plus little h over square root of 2. And this was our convention to give this value of the VEV. But just to warn you, there's also an alternative convention. That you can expand h as 0, and then v plus h over square root of 2. So the different conventions just vary in v by this factor of square root 2. And in this convention, v would be around 174 GeV. OK, so typically, if you're reading a paper and you come across this factor of v, you have to be very careful that you're able to identify what convention is, because basically flip a coin to figure out which one people are using. OK. Now, we had this interaction here for the case of the muon decaying. But we can generate a larger set of interactions by integrating out the W, because the W couples to quarks in addition to leptons. So the full set of charge current interactions are described as follows at low energy. So we have G Fermi over square root of 2. And then I can imagine all sorts of different types of leptons coupled together. So I have to just include these generation indices. Okay? So this is the coupling of all sorts of leptons, I and J, coupled together. This is called the leptonic charge current interaction. I also have the couplings of quarks. So here I have to sum over I, J, and K. This was just a sum over I and J. And I need factors of the CKM matrix, Vij. And then I have U bar I, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, Dj. And then I have E, K, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, nu K, plus summation conjugate. This one is called semi-leptonic, okay, because half of the current is leptonic and the other part is involving the quarks. And then lastly, I have terms involving four quarks. Sum over four different generations, I, J, K, and L. I have two factors of the CKM matrix. U bar I, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, dj, d bar L, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, u k, plus Hermitian conjugate. And this part is the hadronic charge current interaction. Okay, so the standard model, you can see, is very predictive. From one gauge interaction, I'm able to write down a whole host of different couplings between all sorts of different species. So experimentally, you can try to measure all these different types of couplings, purely hadronic couplings, purely leptonic couplings, and then semi-leptonic ones where you're involving weak decays both on the quark side and on the semi-leptonic side. And the prediction of the standard model is that it's all defined within a finite set of parameters. All of the couplings here are related to the same G Fermi plus the CKM matrix. That's how we knew that the standard model must involve a gauge theory. If you just start writing down four fermion operators, the coefficient of every single one is an independent parameter. But if it emerges from a gauge theory, as we saw, it's much more predictive because the overall coefficient must be the same because the gauge coupling is the same. The boson coupling, sorry, the boson mass, the W boson mass is the same for all of them. And so with just this additional CKM matrix factor in front of some of the terms, we can predict everything. So this is a consequence. Of the fact that it comes from an SU2 left cross U1Y gauge theory, where you know the gauge coupling G is the same. It's just a gauge coupling. Okay. All right. Any questions so far?
So would the sum just run over generations whose mass are less than the W mass?
Yeah.
For example, this wouldn't work for the top quark.
That's right. So you wouldn't write down this theory for the top quark. Exactly. Any other questions? Yeah.
We also saw that you can have some hidden relationships between the parameters just from symmetry breaking. So with mm-hmm. So what's the difference?
Yeah, so here the consequence is that GF is the same. So that you have this hidden relation in the sense of it's the same overall coupling, GF, in front of every single four fermion interaction. Even though once you if you expanded out these sums, you would have tens of different terms in your Lagrangian. But the argument is that they have to have the same overall coefficient in front. That's the consequence of the gauge interaction. It doesn't necessarily depend on the fact that it comes from a symmetry breaking term. So, I mean, I guess the factor of MW comes into the denominator of GF, but that's the only consequence. There is a hidden relation from the fact that V is a unitary matrix. So V in general has nine entries, it's 3 by 3, but not all of those entries are independent because it's a unitary matrix. And it's a simple exercise to count the number of free parameters in that unitary matrix, and there's only 4. So in terms of GF plus 4 extra parameters from the CKM matrix V, you can write down all of these, you know, tens of different interactions. And then you can test them. Okay. Any other questions? All right, so you may feel empowered. We have the standard model. It's very predictive. And so you might think to yourself, oh, I can calculate anything. But it's not quite true. Aside from the fact that calculating certain things is just hard, there are some things which it's not even possible to calculate analytically due to the strong interaction, in a sense. So I just want to give you a simple example of something that cannot be calculated completely from first principles due to the physics of the strong interaction. But we can still calculate most of it. That will end up being almost good enough. I guess you'll see how far we can get. So the example that I want to do is I want to consider the weak decay of hadrons, in particular. We're going to be considering charged pions. So you may know pions are the lightest hadrons that we have. They're mesons. There's a pi plus, which is a u and a d bar, and a pi minus, which is a d and a u bar. And the masses of the charged pion is around 140 MeV. And the only thing you really need to know about these things is that their spin, J, is 0. And their parity is minus. Intrinsic parity is minus. And then their spin, J equals 0. So they're often referred to as pseudoscalar mesons. A function that's odd under parity is a pseudoscalar function. That's where that language comes from. OK, so what I want to do is consider the pi minus, and it can decay through a weak decay. So we're going to compute the matrix element for that decay. What can it decay into? Well, it can't decay into anything related to quarks, because there's no other lighter state made out of quarks. So it could decay into leptons. So we're going to consider it decaying into a charged lepton, which I'll denote L. So this will be like the charged minus charged lepton, and then the corresponding antineutrino. And here, L could be muon, or it could be electron. Both of those are lighter than the pion, so both of those would be allowed. So this could be E, or it could be mu. OK, so here's what we want to compute. I'll just draw a Feynman diagram. So we're starting out with a pi minus, and it's this down quark and an anti-up quark. And in order to get a lepton out, we need the W. So the quark lines have to come together. And then through the W, they can annihilate to produce this lepton and the corresponding neutrino. Okay. So it's a little bit different compared to the calculation for muon decay, just because our Lagrangian doesn't have pions in the theory. We have quarks in our theory of the weak interaction. So in order to write this down, we have to consider, we have to carefully consider what happens with an initial state that's actually a pion. And so we want to think of the pion as being an initial state that gets annihilated by the appropriate combination of quark fields. So when I compute this matrix element, here's what I'm going to want to compute. I want a state where I start out with a pion. And let's say it has momentum q. And then the final state will be this lepton and neutrino with momenta p1 and p2. And then I want to consider the right operator that will annihilate, that will convert the incoming state to the outgoing state. So I want to, of course, think about it, you know, by perturbation theory. So I want to insert the interaction Lagrangian. And so so this is the object that I want to insert, df over square root of 2. I have a factor of the CKM matrix, VUD. Then I'll have a lepton field, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, neutrino fields. And I have u bar, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, down type fields, and like this. Okay. So the lepton part of this is all very straightforward from what you know about deriving Feynman rules. You know, in momentum space, you just contract the corresponding field with the state, and you end up getting this factor of a plane wave times the appropriate spinner. So we'll do this contraction here. This part will contract here. This one will get contracted here. And then I'll just get this sandwiched inside of the spinner. So I'll get I gf over square root of 2, VUD. I'll still have this integral over position. I'll have e to the I p1 plus p2 dotted into x. These are the plane wave factors that you always get whenever you contract a field that depends on position with the, you know, corresponding momentum state. And then you have u bar p1 for the lepton, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5, b nu l, and then p2. OK, so this is the part that's exactly the same as what you would usually derive from momentum space Feynman rules. But we're still left over with the quark parts. We've contracted the states with the corresponding fields, which will annihilate these states. And so I'm just left over with the vacuum on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, I still have my initial state. And then I still have the appropriate fields here. So I have u bar, gamma mu, 1 minus gamma 5 d. And just to be explicit, I'll put in the position dependence. So this is supposed to be a function of x. OK. So here I am stuck, because if I don't know anything, I don't know how to compute this matrix element. If I'm not able to solve the strong interaction, I can't compute what this matrix element is. So, so it's unknown from first principles. Mainly because I don't know the wave function of the pion. So I don't know how the up and down quarks are distributed in this pion state. So it's unknown because we don't, because we can't solve the non-perturbative dynamics. Of the strong interaction at low energy. You can do a computer calculation. You can use a supercomputer to compute this matrix element from first principles. That's in a program known as Lattice QCD. But I can't do that on the blackboard right now. So it's unknown. But we'll just parameterize our ignorance as best we can using the principles of symmetry to figure out how it depends on quantities that enter into the calculation. So I can think about this matrix element. So let's look at this operator. There's one part which is just a vector current, which is the part involving the 1. And there's another one which is an axial vector current, which is the part involving the gamma 5. So in a sense, I have two different operators to think about. The part with the vector current is easy. This one must be 0. The reason it's 0 is due to parity invariance. So the strong interaction conserves parity, although the weak interaction does violate it. Here, when we're just talking about matrix elements of operators, it's dominated by the strong interaction. And so I can assume, for the purposes of this argument, that parity is conserved.
Sorry, so what violates the parity there?
Yeah, let me write down the other matrix element, and then it'll be more clear why it's forbidden. So the other operator is u bar x gamma mu gamma 5 dx pi minus q. OK, and this one is allowed. And so I should expand this in terms of Lorentz invariant structures, or I should say Lorentz covariant objects. So it has a mu index. So the only index with a mu floating around would be this momentum q here. Then there's a factor of e to the minus I q dot x. And then the thing that I don't know is the overall coefficient of this term. And so that is canonically defined as minus I f pi. OK. Here I have an axial vector current and a pseudoscalar state. If I transform under parity, then what I should get out is a vector object. And so this is what I have. Momentum is just a vector. If I had a vector current and a pseudoscalar state, what I should get out is an axial vector. I can't construct anything out of one momentum, which is an axial vector. I'd have to write down an epsilon tensor. And I don't have enough free momenta to use an epsilon tensor. I need to have an epsilon tensor and then 3 other momenta to play around with, which I don't have from just this.
But couldn't you, but the gamma mu, gamma 5 is axial, right?
Yeah, that's right. This is the axial one.
Yeah, but you'd have to make an axial vector on top.
So it's axial vector here, but it's also a pseudoscalar state. And so you get an additional minus sign. So what you want here is the vector, because it's also a pseudoscalar. And here you have a vector current but then a pseudo-scalar state, so the whole thing must be an axial vector.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, couldn't you use gamma 5 to make that axial vector as well?
Oh, no, I mean, the operator is fixed, and so I'm just considering this particular matrix element for the vector operator and this particular one for the axial vector one. Yeah. What do you want to do?
Do you mean like putting the gamma 5 on the right-hand side?
Oh, yeah, there's no more spinner indices floating around either. Yeah, so you can't put anything with spinner indices on the right-hand side because you're contracting all of the spinner indices on the left-hand side. There's no extra indices floating around to use. Okay. The other part, maybe it's not quite obvious, is how do you get this exponential part? If you wanted to prove that you get this exponential part, you have to put in a translation operator. So for example, you can do it like this. So let me insert a translation operator. E to the I p, so this is a momentum operator, dotted into x, e to the minus I p dotted into x, and then the same thing over here. Here, these two will act on this operator to translate it to the position at 0. And so the operator now won't depend on x anymore. So I'll have 0, e to the I, p dot x, and then u bar at 0, gamma mu, gamma 5, d of 0. And then I'll just have e to the minus I, p dot x, acting on the pion. Here I just get the momentum operator acting on this state of given momentum will just give me q. And translation operator acting on the vacuum will just give me 1, since the vacuum's invariant under translations. So now I have this. Okay, this whole thing now cannot depend on x, and so I should define it as some overall constant and then momentum q. But now the x dependence has to be exactly in this exponential. So in case that was something you're worried about, there you go. Okay, so what we've computed is this matrix element, and don't know what it is. And you can think of this as basically just parameterizing our ignorance. But we've worked out, but in terms of this coefficient, we can keep going and calculate the matrix element in terms of this coefficient f pi.
That f pi can't depend on something like the momentum squared or?
Yeah, exactly. It would in general. So it can depend on q because because f pi itself is a Lorentz scalar, it has to only depend on q squared. And q squared is fixed. So you could write down f pi as a function of q squared. But since q squared is just m pi squared, this is what I mean by f pi. But if you could probe that coupling at different momenta, in general, it would. OK. All right. So now that we have f pi, let's keep going. We can write down the matrix element in terms of f pi. So we have pi minus to L nu L bar. So what we have is GF VUD over square root of 2. We have F pi. We have U bar V1 for the lepton. We have Q slash 1 minus gamma 5. And then V nu L for the antineutrino. And the Q slash comes from just the Q in the matrix element just getting contracted with gamma mu here. And then the other part that I have is I have these complex exponentials floating around. Once I do the x integral, I'll get overall energy momentum conservation. And typically, when you write down the matrix elements in momentum space, you separate out the overall factor of energy momentum conservation. So we'll just write it as times 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 q minus q1 minus q2. We'll put this in parentheses because now I have the momentum space matrix element. OK, so with this, it's straightforward to go through the process of computing the decay rate. You would just square the matrix elements, do the right integrals over phase space, divide by twice the muon mass, and you're done. And so what you get is pi minus to L nu L bar is GF squared VUD squared over 8 pi. You'll have F pi squared, ML squared, M pi, times a phase space factor of 1 minus ML squared over M pi squared. And then this whole thing is squared. OK, so this is what you would get if you do the calculation. It's straightforward to check. We also assume that the neutrino is massless as well. OK. Now, something very interesting happens here. So you may have noticed that the whole amplitude itself is proportional to the lepton mass. Where did that come from? We use the Dirac equation here. So u left p1, and then q slash is p1 slash plus p2 slash v nu l p2. So the neutrino is massless. So oh, I forgot 1 minus gamma 5. Neutrino is massless. So the p2 will go through here. I'll have to change this to a plus. But it doesn't matter. Once it hits the v spinner, it gives me 0 if the neutrino is massless. The p1 will act over here to give me the lepton mass. So I'll still have this 1 minus gamma 5 and then the v spinner. So the whole matrix element is proportional to the lepton mass itself. So I argued it could decay into either one of two ways, into the muon or into the electron. But the muon's a lot heavier. So preferentially, it wants to decay into the muon. Even though it has less phase space available for the decay, this phase space factor will be smaller for the muon. This term in front wins. OK, so so the amplitude is proportional to the lepton mass. And so this tells me that the rate for the charged pion going into the muon is much, much larger than the same rate going into the electron. If you actually calculate it, This branching ratio is around 99.99%, and this one is around 0.01%. This one is about 10 to the minus 4 times smaller than this. The other thing I should mention is that once we compute this decay rate, we have fixed this constant f pi. So the observed value of gamma to mu nu mu fixes f pi, and it's around 130 MeV. OK. Of course, the ratio between these two terms only depends, the f pi dependence will cancel out. So this actually is nice. It's a very easy way to see experimentally that the weak interaction is maximally chiral. So this is like experimental proof. That the weak charge current interaction is maximally chiral. So I just mean that it only couples, so W only couples to left-handed particles and right-handed antiparticles. It could have been flipped the other way. It's not. So in this case of the standard model, it is this way as I described. All right, so how can we see that? So we want to consider pi minus decaying at rest. So let's say we have a pi minus here. And if you have a chiral interaction, of course, it's just a two-body decay at rest. The decay products go off back to back. So let's say the muon goes off like this, and the antineutrino will go off like this. If it's a chiral interaction, then the interaction through the W will want to make a left-handed particle. So left-handed particle means that the spin is anti-aligned here. And a right-handed antiparticle. So if all fermions are massless, then the chirality of the fermions is the same as the helicity. So if I have this maximally chiral coupling of the W, then I have to produce the same helicity states as the chirality states that the W couples to. So if the W is coupling to left-handed muons, spin has to be like this. Right-handed antineutrinos, spin has to be like this. But you can see, if I add together the total spin of these two things, these two will add together, I'll get a total spin state of 1. Which contradicts the fact that we started out with a spinless pion. So in order for this reaction to proceed, I need to violate this assumption that the fermions are massless. So what we must have is that we have pi minus well, the neutrino really is massless, at least within the minimal standard model. So it must be still right-handed, because it's the antineutrino. But in order to get something that's spin zero, I must have a right-handed muon as well. This is allowed as long as the muon is not massless, which is not. So it's allowed, but must depend on the mass for the helicity flip. So this tells me that the amplitude is proportional to the lepton mass. Okay? So that's the point. Okay. Any questions on this? All right, so I just have a minute left, and I just want to summarize where we're at with the standard model. So I want to list the parameters of the standard model. We had three gauge couplings. G, G prime, and GS. We had two Higgs parameters. So you could take them to be mu squared and lambda, like this. We had 9 fermion masses, or equivalently 9 eigenvalues in our Yukawa matrix. So we had mu, mu, m tau, mu, mc, mt, MD, MS, MB. Then we have the CKM matrix elements. As I mentioned, it's constrained because it has to be a unitary matrix. And also, some of the parameters of this unitary matrix are actually unphysical because they correspond to just overall phase redefinitions of the fields. It turns out that there's only 4 physical parameters in the CKM matrix. So we have 4 parameters here. We also introduced other parameters. We had MW, MZ, the Higgs-Vev, the Higgs-mass, MH. But all of those are derived parameters. Once you fix everything else here, then you can derive what those are numerically. There's also another parameter in the standard model, which I'm not going to discuss in this course. There's an extra parameter called theta QCD. And there's an additional term in the strong interaction that you can write down that turns out to be CP violating, and the coefficient of that term is this parameter theta QCD. If that parameter were non-zero, it would give rise to contributions to CP violating observables, such as electric dipole moments. But whenever we've tested so far to measure what this parameter is, everything is consistent with this parameter being zero, which is one of the unknown mysteries of the standard model. Why is this parameter that could be of order one very small, or maybe zero? So I'm not going to discuss it. So experimentally, theta QCD is very small. How small? Well, less than around 10 to the minus 10 or so. So this is it. These are the parameters of the standard model. In principle, you can compute everything in terms of these parameters. But of course, in practice, there are limitations. So we can't compute things, or at least I should say it's difficult to compute things involving the strong interaction. So I can say everything can be computed. Except things that are just hard to calculate, strong interactions. So. In particular, at low energy. And then the other thing that's not computable in the standard model are just the things that the standard model doesn't address. So there are still unsolved problems in the standard model. For example, neutrino masses. You could add other things to this as well, like dark matter, et cetera. Neutrino mass is, in principle, not too complicated. You would just introduce new parameters, aside from the ones that I wrote down. But other issues often involve new degrees of freedom, which so far are just unknown. OK? So that's where we're at. We have how many? 5, 9, 18. So maybe 19. The other weird thing is, why are there so many parameters? It would be nice if it was just one parameter. That would be really cool. But there are 19. And why do they have those particular values? Well, who knows why? OK, that's all for today. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about more about symmetries in the standard model.